and you welcome you and Lochiel. So don't be concerned that you don't have the score. That's by design. I'll just say a little bit about each of those three tunes. I'll sing the bits of the tunes. Then Mike will do the same in relation to his tunes, whether or not he wants to have put the scores to you before he, or at the same time as he's talking about them, that's up to him. Thereafter, once we've both gone through our sets of three tunes, we'll divide up into two. I'll take anybody who's interested in going through my tunes in more detail through to another room. We can talk about embellishments, illustrate the way of the tunes on the charter, and you'll have the scores and the notes. And we can swap about thereafter, depending on how much time we've got. So you should each get an opportunity to be well introduced to six tunes in total during the course of the morning. Now, Pembroke is easy, okay? Pembroke is easy. It's easiest if you learn it by ear rather than from the page. I think it's important to get the oral message before you get the visual message. Okay? You cannot write Pembroke accurately in staff notation. The nature of the music is such that it doesn't lend itself to being imprisoned in bars or behind bars. So, if you've got recording instruments, get them going now, put them on, put your phones on so that you can get the way of the tune through your lungs. Try and learn the tune, learn the song of the tune by ear. You don't have to memorize it completely, but get the way of the tune orally before you look at the score. Then when you look at the score, you'll be able to appreciate that it approximates to what's already in your head, what you're already familiar with because you've been listening to it. And you'll then appreciate the significance of the fermata, the pause mark, which is really important when it comes to Pembroke because of the nature of the music. It doesn't follow a beat necessarily. Some tunes do, but very few of them do. We'll talk about scansion, the pattern of accented and unaccented notes within a phrase, and that's a great aid to being able to portray the tune, to express the tune on the bagpipe. If you can get the tune really fixed in your brain through singing it a lot to yourself, looking at the score as little as possible, when you get it into your head and you come to play it on the bagpipe, what you're playing is what's already in your head. You're playing the song of the tune on the bagpipe. Try not to visualize the score. Don't close your eyes and see a score in front of you and play from that. That's not the way of it at all. Get it into your head first, sing it, and then play what's in your head on the bagpipe. We don't want a big, strong bagpipe that you're going to have to struggle with. Nice, melodious, easy pipe, so that you can be playing it and forget all that goes with getting a bagpipe going well. Forget the bagpipe, so you're playing the song. Okay? All this I've probably said to various of you before, and you're probably sick of hearing it. But probably one of the worst things that happened to Pembroke was it was put on paper in the first place. It was always transmitted orally. You'll be familiar with cantroch, the Gaelic word for chanting. And of course, in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, when Pembroke first became written on paper, it was written in vocables. Every note and every grace note had a vocable, a little word associated with it, so you could go up and down the scale singing different notes, but it was sung. If you look at Angus Mackay's book, various of the tunes have the words underneath the stave. The tune was a Pibroch version of a well-known song, and that's how many, many of the tunes originated. The three tunes I'm going to talk about today, certainly there's a possibility that two of them originated as songs and were simply songs put into Pibroch form. Ground, theme, variation, variation, variation following stereotyped patterns of embellishment. But that's as it might be. Latterly, people have composed Pibrochs that aren't associated with traditional songs at all. They're simply derived from what might be in a piper's head as a good going sort of a tune. Let's put that into Pibroch form, let's give it some variations, and that's it. It's as much Pibroch as some of the 18th, 17th century tunes that we've grown up with. First tune I'm going to talk about is the Chisholm Salute. It follows the same pattern in terms of variations, same structure as the Glen Is Mine. So any of you who are already familiar with the Glen Is Mine will very easily relate to the Chisholm Salute. Now I'll sing it. So it goes like this. Singing the Glen Is Mine.
In a different key.
Well, yeah, that bears out the point. It's very similar. Brui, I'll start again. Brui, oh ya, brui, ano. Brui, oh ya, brui, ano. Brui, ahi, anche. Substituted for some of the F's in the ground. Brui, oh ya, brui, ano. You increase the tempo ever so slightly for that thumb variation, and then there's a doubling of the thumb variation. A few more high A's kicking in, and slightly faster again. And so on through line two and line three. Then you come to what might be regarded as more conventional variations, a Lunlua variation, where you're playing grip movements to E all the way. But we start, rather than on an E, again like the Glen is Mine, we start these variations with a low A. Doubling of that Lunlua variation, no cadences. Grip movements instead all the way, increase the tempo. Second line, third line. Then drop back the tempo for the singling of the Tolua variation. Here, same theme notes all the way, same cadences. You play Tolua movement, low A to start with, from all the theme notes, Tolua movement to low A. That's the variation. Doubling of that same pattern all the way through, no cadences. Tolua's to low A all the time, increase the tempo. Even in the doublings of these variations, where if you look at the score, all the notes are the same, try and think of it in its phrases, and you're showing the first and the fourth, the start of the phrase and the finish of the phrase, ever so subtly. Don't make a big thing about it. A listener unacquainted with what you're doing would probably be unaware of what it is that you're using to show the architecture of the tune by this subtle phrasing. But that's where the artistry of piano playing comes in. If you hear somebody playing a tune like this tune, and you can beat your foot to it, and it's not got any shape to it at all. You think, oh, well, yes, that's all very good playing, good bagpipe, good fingers, but where's the song? You need to be able to discern the song from start to finish all the way. So once you get to the end of your doubling of the Tolua variation, drop back the tempo for the singling of the Krunlua variation. They don't need to be fast. The main thing about Krunlurs and Krunlur marks is the ripple effect. Don't try and play the movement too fast. Try and strive for a consistent ripple effect from every note. Every embellishment should sound the same. So then line two, line three, following the same pattern as all those preceding variations. Krunlur mark, dead easy. Krunlur marks, we think they're difficult because they're unusual. They're not in all the tunes. But keep it slow. Get the ripple effect. Then back to the ground. Customary to play the first line of the ground. This is the serpent swallowing its tail. This is eternity. This is coming back to the beginning. Chisholm having been elected to the UK Parliament as a member for the County of Inverness. This tune was very popular at the Northern Meeting piping competitions after it had been composed in 1836 because, guess what, the Chisholm was often one of the judges. I've not heard it played in competition very much this last 50 years, but it's a great wee tune. It's easily memorized. There's nothing in it that anybody would find all that difficult in terms of technique. Nothing unconventional at all about it. So we can go through it on the chanter and go into the details of embellishments and do whatever else you want to do with it after this session.